Today is the 18th of the 3rd, 2016. Today I'm interviewing Faye Hanna. Faye is a retired horticulturalist, and now Faye is going to tell us something about her family and the start to today. Faye, would you like to tell us something about the family?
Yes, I would. I think I've got quite an accomplished family when I think back of what my ancestors went through. My grandfather was a Dane. He came here as a very young man and, as I understand, was not very much English. He worked as a labourer around the area until he got established. He met my grandmother, who lived in Otani, and they established their family in Otani, called Kaikoura North then. He opened a bakery. He had four sons and a daughter, and they all lived to work in around this Hawke's Bay area. My father was hard. He was the third son. He married my mother, who was Emma Mia, and her parents and her mother, she was one of a second marriage, but my mother had come here from England sometime in the 18th century and brought all her family with her, and they also lived around the Hawke's Bay southern area. My grandfather losing his life very early in a mill accident because they were in timber. My father met my mother around the 1928s, I would think, and married and bought a property in Namoko. It was the time of the Depression. I don't quite know how they did it, but things were very tight. I was born in 1931, my brother a year later, and my sister 2 years after that. My very, very first recollection was being put to sleep in the hay barn, just at the milking shed. As I said, times were very tough. It was in the Depression. Father was a sheep farmer in reality, but I think to make ends meet, they had a few cows because then it brought in a monthly deposit to the bank, as it were, to keep them going. Father went out and shore sheep, and from memory, and I don't know how correct this is, but he used to talk about shearing sheep with a friend, and they did sheds and worked very hard. And he used to talk about getting 30 bob a hundred, which, to those that don't know that lingo, it was £1.10, which wasn't very much. But he earned that, and mother milked the cows to bring in some money during the month. We had a jolly good childhood when I look back, and a very good teen years. We went to the Norswood School, which was 4 miles away. The farm was at Namoko, which is 4 miles straight into the Ruahine Range. John Legarth drove the school bus, and he collected us and took us to school, and we went out through Garfield and picked up various ones, and he brought us home and dropped us off at night. And incidentally, he took us also to high school many years later, but that's another story. Mr. Stretton was the headmaster at the time. He was just about to retire, and there were Miss Maguire and Miss Wilson, who were, and there was another teacher, usually a junior teacher that came, but that varied from time to time. There were four classrooms then, and it is one of the remaining schools in that area. Ormondville School, the Norswoods, Matamau School, where else, Makutiku, all those ones have closed down and they all congregate in Norswood these days, I'm told. My sister and I were there last year and we went in to see the school, given a great welcome, and it's amazing what 50 years later does to a school.
During that time, Faye, what was it like living out in the country? It must have been pretty quiet because there was no television, there was no the fun you made yourselves.
That's quite right, Frank. We made our own fun. Coming up from Norswood, you went down quite a steep hill, or I thought it was very steep in those days. When I look at it now, it's a bit of a bump. Mm-hmm. But when you come down the hill, it was called what we used to call, be related to as the valley. And it was made up of small dairy farms, mostly dairy farms, about, you know, anything 60 acres, 70 sure. acres, yes. something like that. Howard had quite a big holding for that sort of thing. There were 200 acres at the house, and he later bought 50 acres up this hill. But in those days, there were small holdings, and because there were young families, the Thompson family came very soon after my parents. So they had three kids, all of our ages. And of course, we played a lot together. We made our own fun. We went eeling in the creeks. We dammed in the summer. We used to dam up the creek to make a swimming pool where we all learnt to swim. And then the winter had come and it had washed it away and we'd have to do the whole thing again next year.
Yes.
The weather was a lot different to what it is now. You will see photos of me and my siblings making a snowman. We used to get snowed in quite regularly, and of course there weren't the tractors and things to clear the snow to get up the hill, so you just hankered down and you didn't even have to go to school, which was pretty good. We did get a lot of snow, but we had lots of fun. We had sport at school, of course, and we had great competition between Ormondville and our schools, and our school in Tackerbal with rugby and basketball, as it was called then.
Yes.
Norswood was quite a community. It had three garages and the post office. We had umpteen churches, which was quite amazing, really. Some of them are still there and some of them aren't. The Salvation Army used to come up every Sunday and collect us all in a baby Austin car, and we had Sunday school at the various parents' houses, and that was fun. We all used to squash in this little car, as you can imagine. And they were resident in Norswood. Mr. Coombe was the garage that we used to go to. And after the war, the Risma brothers built one. There was two hotels. There was a picture theatre. And during the war, we used to go to the matinee. And then during the winter, as we got older, we had lots of fun. Winter entertainment was dancing,
yes.
balls, all the areas in the everybody's, every little community, like there was a community in Ormondville. There was a community at Makutiku. And all and one in Takapau, all these little towns which are just about obsolete now, but they were quite a thriving business area for the community surrounding them. You must remember that we didn't hair off to Hastings or Palmerston North or something like they would do these days if they wanted to buy anything substantially. Danny Werk was our nearest town, which was quite big. That was where the doctor was and the dentist was, and if you wanted something like a car, you were looking at cars, all that.
Yes.
That was this was when I was young. That was a bit before the time of everybody having a car. Fortunately, Hard, my father, always had a car. The weekends were the social time for a family to go and have Sunday dinner with Uncle Joe and Auntie Mary, or they would come to us, or we would go to some other friend, the Ellisons or something, some other person. And that was our family entertainment in the weekend. That was in the winter, and you went and had Sunday dinner in the middle of the day, and then you went home, of course, to a big open fire. There were there was no central heating or television or anything like that. We read a lot. We all had to learn to play the piano. We had sing songs around the pianos. My mother's family were very musical. And when we went to Danny Werk, to Auntie Mary's and Auntie Hattie's, you always ended up by, everybody was round the piano, and you used to have to play your latest thing bumbled through that you'd learned that week on the piano.
So Robin's Return and the Black Hawk Waltz and all of those.
All those things, and we learned to sing, and we learned to sing lots of old songs that you only hear now in films, perhaps wartime films. It's like Pack Up Your Troubles in the Old Kit Bag, and all those sort of things. And we all sang, and we were all expected to sing. My father had a lovely voice, my mother had a lovely voice. It was just a natural thing to all stand around the piano and yell your lungs out, whether you were on tune or not, but we were usually on tune.
Yes.
Yeah. It was just part of weekends in the winter. In the summer, it was different because that was the busier time on the farm, the shearing, the hay making, all those things. I don't know how it originated, but very early on in my life, I can remember that on Sundays, Mother packed the cake tins and the pie into the boot of the car, and we all scrambled in, and we went down to the Manawatu River to have a picnic. Now, nobody said, "Are you going to the picnic?" Everybody just arrived. Everybody knew if they were free and they didn't have visitors, even if they did, everyone went down, and you will see somewhere in the file a photo of these picnics.
Yes,
Mum, Dad and the kids all went, and that was lovely. Paddled, really. I can't ever remember there being a very deep part to swim, but we got in it and the water ran round us and it was all fun.
Because this was really the upper Manawatu.
Yes. Oh, yes. It was the source of the Manawatu.
That's right.
And that was all very nice. As we got a bit older, as I say, we all these little communities had balls, the Women's Institute, the RSA, the National Party. Keith Holyoake and Mrs. Holyoake always came to the National Party balls, and Mother and Father got very friendly with them. And I actually went and worked, my sister and I actually went later on in life when we had finished schooling, we went down to Nelson and worked for the Holyoakes in their tobacco farm, much like kids today sort of come out here from other countries to do the seasonal work. But we had lovely entertainment with the balls. We made all our ball gowns, and you had at least four or five long gowns with the white gloves and the white cape, and you went. You might go with a partner, but usually when you were quite young, you went with your parents. Dad had his dinner suit and always wore a black tie, as the men did. Mother had her long dress, and we all danced to Billy Tea Towel's orchestra. And Billy Tea Towel was the pianist. The Ellison brothers had their violins, and Mr. Brown was on the drum. It was grand fun. We learned all the old dances when we were very young. We learnt those at school, actually, for the fancy dress ball that we had each year. And we all learnt to waltz and to one step and do the Valita and the Maxina and the Gay Gordons, all those things that you probably, listening to this, you kids don't know anything about, but you missed a lot of fun.
You're quite right. Today, they don't even dance together.
No.
They stand apart. We actually held one another discreetly.
Wriggle.
That's right.
Oh, yes, no. When I look back, I would not have changed what I had. Mm. As you got older, we had to go to high school. In that era, or where my family was concerned, there was no suggestion that you should go to university and further your education. It was just something that wasn't done. Perhaps with very wealthy families in township where people were in professions, that was probably a different thing, but we in the country went to high school, did our 3 years, got our school certificates, and then we went and worked, either in Dannevirk or the boys took apprenticeships. My brother did a carpentering apprenticeship, my sister did hairdressing, and I got a job in the post office. For winter, we did our balls and things, but also in Norswood, there was a bowling club and a tennis club. My parents both bowled and I played tennis. And then some bright spark thought it would be a good idea if the girls formed a marching team. Now, this was right out of the blue, really out of the blue. And we were a pretty motley crowd when you think of the marching teams today, who are all girls of about 4 or 5, and they're all slim, and they're all out of the one mould. Well, we weren't. We had short ones and fat ones and tall ones and skinny ones, but we had a lot of fun. Yes. And somewhere along here, there's a photograph of the marching team. Laurie Resmer and used to coach us, and he had a garage. And when it was pouring with rain, we had to go and march in the garage. He used to collect us up and take us in. That was fun. The other thing in winter we did, we were all very close to the Dannevirk Pipe Band. All my cousins that lived in Dannevirk before, this was before the war, Auntie Mary had 5 sons. Les died very early in his teens, but the other all belonged to the pipe band and they were all drummers. After the war, George Peters, who was the pipe major, got everybody together, and we used to have Inglesides. We used to have them at the Matimal Hall and at the Oddfellows Hall in Dannevirke, and we used to have one from memory every fortnight. I can't remember if it was a week or every fortnight, but there was one law. You could not jive or one step or foxtrot. You had to do the traditional dance. And when we all started, some of us didn't know the various things. I knew them because we used to dance round the kitchen round table at the farm, because my mother was a great dancer. But George would lead with one of the girls that knew the steps, and we all had to do the traditional dance, and it was great fun.
I can imagine.
It really was.
Yes.
It really was.
So what age would you have been then at that stage?
Probably about 17.
So you would have just started working.
Yes. Yes. The war broke out when I was young, small of course. Well,
you're only 8 years old.
Yes, I was eight. I thought I was seven, but I was eight. So that, you know, the time the guys got home from the war, I was still at primary school, if I remember, when the war broke out. Yeah, I'd be about 17 when I left high school. I took commercial at high school. There weren't very many options. In those days, you either took a commercial class or you did English class where you learned French. Well, I took the commercial class and did figures. And that was good. We seemed to get through. We had our science teacher, our music teachers. We all learned to play the piano, not at school, but we sort of came out. We did history and geography a lot, of course, and English, spelling, all those sort of things. But none of my friends went on to university. It's just something that didn't come up. I was fortunate enough to get a job in the Norswood Post Office. There were very few job openings, but there was the Norswood Post Office and the telephone exchange, which had to be manned, and there were 3 6-hour shifts from 6 a.m. to midnight, and I started on one of the shifts, and then I was promoted to do the work at the counter. Now, in those days, the post office was a lot different to what it is today. We did everything at the post office. We collected income tax, we paid out pensions, we registered cars, you name it, we did it. And fortunately for me, a John Oliver took over from Mr. Wells, the elderly postmaster, who retired to West Shore. And John Oliver was younger, much younger. I should imagine he was about 40. He was a very good teacher, and he took this rural recruit off the exchange, and he taught me all the things that I should know: how to register cars, how to do birth, deaths and marriages, how to do the war pensions, anything that came into the post office, and everything did then. And I was very, very well trained, which later on, in a few years, when my parents built a house in Hastings and I moved down here with them when I was 21, I was transferred to the Havelock North Post Office, but that's another story. Going back to the farm, it was fun. In those days, we had the school year was in three terms, so that you had plenty of time at the farm. We didn't go away for holidays a lot. We used to come down to West Shore as we got older and mother and father would rent a cottage at West Shore, which I might say in those days was so stony you could hardly walk on it in bare feet.
I can imagine.
Dad used to wear tennis shoes when he went. But that was a lovely place, and there was a dear little dairy there that used to sell lovely lots of chocolates. And when Father was in a really grand and expansive mood, he used to send me along to the shop with some money, and I can't remember how much it was. To me it was awful lot, but it probably wasn't. And I used to buy an assortment of chocolates, and then we used to go and eat them at West Shore with our sandy uniforms and our sandier hands probably. But that was the only holidays that we ever used off the farm.
Sure.
We used to help with the docking and the shearing and all those sort of things that went on at the heart when there was dipping. We couldn't do much then, but it was all fun. We used to help Dad bring the frock in when there was something that had to be done in the farm, and we all did it, and you were just expected to do it. It wasn't a chore, as it were. It was just an expectation. And in those days, Dad used to sort, when after the sheep had lambed, he'd sort the ewe with twins away to put in a paddock on their own, which wasn't so heavily stocked, as opposed to the ewe that just had the one lamb. And we all did it. Mother helped, and that was all fun. And then Dad built a wool shed. Up before then, we used to have to take the sheep up the road to Mr. Dazzler, the end of the road, and shear the sheep there. And Mother would cook in the midday meal in the kitchen at Mrs. Dazzler's, because the men liked a big meal in the middle of the day. But then Hard built a wool shed. Well, that was fun, because we used to hold wool shed dances, and the two pens, they're holding the little pens where the shearer pulled the sheep out, they were given a good scrub and things, because Mother used to serve the supper. We had to have somewhere to put the supper.
Sure.
And again, Billy Teetail used to come and play for the dance music, and they were great times too. To me, it was a big issue, but probably there weren't a lot of people there, just the immediate neighbours. There was probably only about 30 people there.
Yeah.
But it was real fun. And Mum and everybody came, Mum, Dad and the kids. Mm. It was a family outing, and that was fun.
And it was on the farm at home.
And of course we didn't have to worry about, there was no booze, no liquid refreshments like that at all. And going from that, it makes me think of, for my 18th birthday, my father gave me a baby Fiat. You'll see the photo of it somewhere in the archives. And it was like the balls. Sometimes I'd pick up a girlfriend and we'd go in the car. But you never went, once you went into the ballroom, into the hallway, you never ever went out again. We didn't smoke, we didn't drink. There were no issues like that at all. You went to dance, and we danced. And we'd have a big supper, and it was great. But there was no issues about getting home, or if you were with a guy and you actually had a partner that took you, he never drank either.
No.
There was just nothing like that.
And, of course, those were the days of the big enamel teapots.
Yes.
With the mothers on the bench behind pouring the tea.
Yes. And talking about the mothers, in the hall, the mothers always sat along one side. And God help you, really, if you were going to be... You couldn't be naughty, you couldn't do anything, because there were all these pairs of eyes on you, and of course everybody knew you, everybody knew your history, so you couldn't even be slightly naughty. I don't know what you would have done, but you certainly didn't leave the hall with a boy.
And of course the men were all one end of the hall, grouped up as
they
well.
They were there at the door all talking, and the mothers.
Pretending they weren't looking at the girls.
And
yes.
The nice thing about it, when I think back, Hard always used to come and have a dance with me or my sister, or you know. Mm. Dad always used to dance with me, but if I would expect the guy that took me, if I went with a chap, to go and ask my mother to dance, and he would.
Well,
it was very much a family affair.
Part of the etiquette of the time.
Now,
Billy Titow, was his name Titow?
Titow.
How on earth did he get a name, Billy Titow?
Was a Maori.
Yes.
And he farmed. He farmed just out of Norswood. He was a lovely man. I mean, he was just part of the community. I mean, I had a 21st birthday before I came down here, which was the usual thing in a small community. And everybody was asked, and Billy Titow came and played the music for my 21st birthday.
Yeah, so he was very much part of the community.
He was part. I'll tell you a little aside here. Last year, in 2015, my sister said to me in May, she had a birthday on the 28th of May, and we usually take each other out for lunch on our birthdays, and she lives in Waipakarau just right now and then. I said, well, what do you want to do for your birthday? I'll come and take you out to lunch. And she said, well, actually, I would like to go to lunch to Norswood.
Mm.
And she said, I hear there's a very nice little restaurant up. Not a restaurant, really, just a little cafe type thing.
Yes.
And we could have lunch there and look around Norswood, which is a much smaller Norswood than in our day, but still it's there. Mr. Coombs' garage has been made into a museum. There's various other places of historic note that has been preserved. So I took her up to Norswood, and we had lunch, and then we walked around the village. I call it a village because I'm used to Havelock, but we walked around the small community and called it at all the shops and things, didn't know anybody, but the school was having their lunchtime, and I said to my sister, I want to go and have a look at the school. She said, you can't go in there, and I said, watch me. So I opened the big gate, which wasn't there in my day, and everything had grown. There is now 6 classrooms, I think, instead of the 4. And as I said sometime before, all the surrounding areas have closed their school and they all bust to Norswood. So we walked in and introduced ourselves, and we were given a great welcome. And it was something that I was delighted we had done.
Yes, I can imagine.
And when we had finished there, I said to her, why don't we go up to Namoko and have a drive round the old stamping ground? So we went, and we decided that we'd go and see this neighbour's son who had bought my father's farm eventually and the neighbour's small holdings, and he had virtually taken 3 or 4 properties and made them into one farm. So we said, well, we'll try and find him. So we went up to Namoko, and we went down where I thought he still lived and pulled up at their family home that they had always had, and went in, and the strange man came out and said, oh no, he didn't live there now. He only rented the house.
Mm.
So that was all right. Well, we said, did he know where the owner was? And he said, no, I'm sorry, I don't. So we kept on going. And to cut a long story short, we went right up the end of the road to where Father used to shear the sheep, the Dazzlers, and we crawled into various people down the road. And we didn't go into our old house, but we went into various neighbours. And nobody knew where this man was. And what is more, they didn't know the people next door.
Yes, yes, yes.
And so we went on. So I said to Jewel, I'm not going to be jolly well defeated with this. So we kept on going and we went into the Resmers place where I used to play with Shirley. And they didn't know him. And so it went on. I even stopped a couple of cars coming up the road and nobody knew where this man now lived.
Good Lord.
And they didn't know who I should ask. And I suddenly realised that in my day where everybody knew everybody else and you went and played with their kids and you had picnics with them and all the rest, but nobody... It was an area of people who were renting houses. I don't know where they worked. I presume they worked on properties somewhere around or in Dannevirke or in Waipaka Rau, one of them lived worked
yes,
in.
Yes, yes.
So that the whole lovely community that we grew up in has just disintegrated.
Yes. But this has been symptomatic of so many communities.
Oh, it is.
Where the farmers amalgamated, they might not even live on the farm.
They don't.
They rent the houses.
They rent houses.
And so the community disappears.
Yes.
But no, I understood. So then you came home disillusioned that no one.
Well.
Norswood knows anything about the past.
No, they don't. And so I said to Jill, okay, well, she said to me, I'd like to go past Granddad's place. I said, okay. So we got in the car and we went down to the Norswood Ormanville Road. My grandfather farmed there. My father, they all moved after Otani or Kaikoura North, where all my family kids. My uncles and aunts were born, and so we went down. We didn't go in. We didn't like to go in. The day was getting, felt a bit disillusioned, actually, because the house is still there and it's still recognised. Of course, it's been altered slightly. So we went down to Ormanville, only to find that the school had absolutely disappeared. There's nothing there now. Ormanville used to be quite a little community on its own because the train went through it and stopped at Ormanville. And if you were going down to Hastings and Napier on an excursion, as sometimes the school did, you went on the train.
That's right.
So the train station now, I might say, is still there, but it is a backpackers place, so that the trains, there is a train that still goes through. It gets here about at the Longlands crossing about 3:30 in the morning, so you can still say that you've slept in a railway station because the station's still there. But the Tavistock Hope, no, that's Waipaka Rau, the Ormanville Arms, I think. So I said to Jill, I'm going to go in here and let's go in and have a look. Not that we went when we were young ladies. You never went to a hotel when you were a young lady. And the chap was just lighting the open fire, and it's still a hotel that services the area. But he couldn't tell us where to find Ewan either. So,
isn't that amazing?
Yeah. He said, I've heard the name, but he said, that's all. So anyhow, we came back to Waipak down through the on the Hartuma Road, and we'd had a great day.
Yes, yes.
And it was full of memories, but it was a bit disappointing to find that the district had disintegrated.
Yeah. Yes. Well, that's why we need all of this history, because we're catching up and putting the districts back together again.
Yes.
Because so many districts, you know, Flemington, Wimbledon, I didn't even know there was a store and a pub there, all sorts of things.
Yes.
And yet, they're not there now. There was a post office, there was all sorts of things.
See, we used to go dancing to the balls at Whitakura.
Mm.
And it was a dickens of a long way out. Mm. Now it's not. But then it was, you know, a long way from home, but we all went.
Mm. So that brings you to Havelock.
That brings me to
Havelock. Your new adventure.
My big adventure to the big smoke.
You were 20.
My father put a manager on the farm and built a house in Rioter Street in Hastings. My brother at that time was down here in Hastings finishing off his apprenticeship with Helena Brothers, who became quite well known in the Hastings area. Lloyd, Keith, who made billiard tables, and Owen, who died just a few years ago. He used to sit behind me at school, poking me in my back with a pencil. And he was a cabinet maker of some note here.
Mm.
So we came down to Hastings, and of course Faye had to be transferred down here, and John Oliver, the postmaster, took that in hand. And Havelock North wanted a chief account, a cashier, somebody that would take charge of being the main cashier. And John Oliver spoke to the inspector. You used to have inspectors in those days. And he said, she's a bit young. He said, I will guarantee that she knows more about it than the two guys you've got on the counter now, which was very nice for me. He had given me a very good grounding. I could not have had better. So I was transferred to the Havelock North Post Office. I lived at home with my parents, and I still had my Fiat. So it was easy for me to get out of to the post office. Mr. Pankhurst was the postmaster. Of course, I was tiddling out to work one morning. I had to start at 9, so I hoped it was about 8:30, so I wasn't late. And the jolly silencer fell off my Fiat, and I entered Havelock North like a 10-ton truck. Okay. Which brought all the boys to the window, because everybody at that stage was sorting mail. And there was about 6 on the staff at that, because we delivered the mail. And everybody said, what's wrong, as I got to the door? And I said, well, the jolly silence has fallen off the car. And they said to me, in your lunch hour, take it down to that garage down there opposite the borough council and ask for Bill Hanna, and he'll fix it up for you. And that changed my life.
The muffler falling off your car. Yes.
The muffler falling off the car. And really, the time that Bill and my brother had got together, and Bill said to my Father Howard, if you don't get rid of this thing soon, it's going to cost you a lot of money. And not quite then, but in the future, I lost my little car because my fiancé would not let me keep it. So I don't know whether that was a good move or not, because then I didn't have any transport.
And your fiancé, of course, was Bill Hannah.
My fiancé was Bill Hannah, who had the garage.
And and took the car away.
And he did fix it. I'll give him his... Yes. He did fix it, but somewhere down the track he said to my father and my brother, "I think you better sell that thing before it cost you a lot of money." So he did. So that was the beginning of another chapter of my life.
Because those were the days when he had an MG.
Oh, he was very dashing. He had this MGTC. Was it a TD? I'm not quite sure. TC, I think. And he was very dashing in that. And, of course, he used to race it at Manawatu.
Yes.
And uphill climbs and things like that. But that's another story again. There's lots of stories. He had been to the war, of course, and he'd come home. And before he went to the war, he joined the... He was in the Napier Post Office. I can't actually remember what he did at the Napier Post Office. But, of course, he went away a young man, and he was away 4.5 years. So he came back a very different person, he admits himself, than he was when he went away. And he saw a lot of action, but fortunately not too much damage, but that's another story again.
Yeah, sure.
He came back and he had a cousin, Keith Apley, who had joined forces with Eric Shepherd, and they had started a garage service in a little shed. That's all it was. Wasn't even terribly big. It was opposite where the borough council used to have their premises. Mm. It was just up towards in Te Ati Road, just up from Lucknow Road, where Nimmons were with the buses. Middle Road, yes. Te Ati Road was a jolly sight, different when I came than it is now. There's lots of stories
All paddocks on the right-hand side of Te Ati Road.
There was the hotel. I actually stayed at the hotel for about 3 weeks before when I came down to the Crown, wasn't it called? Was it the Crown? Bob Connop and Jean Connop were there.
Eardersley?
No.
Was
it?
Yes, it was the Eardersley.
Was it?
Most of the people call it the Havelock Pub.
Yes. Well, it was the Havelock Pub.
I know.
And Bob and Jean Connop were there when I arrived. They were lovely people. And Bill used to come down on Friday night. We used to have Friday night dinner there because he had to work on Friday night. But I stayed there. They were lovely. And Havelock was an entirely different place then. Going back to Bill and how he got involved in Havelock was that Keith and Eric had started this business, and they asked Bill if he, probably through Keith, his cousin, if he would join them. And the garage was just an old shed, really, and it wasn't very big. And he said he would join them and put money in it, but on the proviso that they built another building. And when I came down here in 1952... Havelock North Motors, as we knew it, or it is now, what is it?
A Shell petrol station.
The Shell service station was just a great big oblong area with boxing all around the outside, not very high, full of metal. And they just put heaps and heaps and heaps of metal in it. And they had dug a trench across the metal. Why they didn't put it in first, I would not know. but it had to have ties, mm-hmm. steel ties, in to keep it all together. Well, that was just going in when I arrived, so it had a long way to go. The Berry brothers built that. I can't remember their names.
Buster
was one.
Yes.
And there was a brother?
Yes, they were well known. They learned their trade when they came back from the war.
Yes. Well, they did the building. There's a photo here I've got that we'll look at one stage or put in somewhere, but out the back there was just paddocks that used to flood a bit in the winter. This is when we were married and out here in Crosby Street. But we used to have a Guy Fox every year with a big fire out the back for the staff and any of the children around. You know, we didn't have, wasn't a public thing. It was just something for the staff. But you couldn't have a fire there now. But that was just waste space out there. There's a photo of it all in water. And there was a police station further up the road. I think that was there when I came in. Mr. Bradford used to live there. Perhaps it wasn't a police station as such, but that's where he and his daughter was, Joan.
Doesn't ring a bell.
It was up about opposite the other garage. And yes, he used to parade down through the village on Friday nights.
Which other garage?
The one there now. Yes. It wasn't there. No, Esther and Horner were up to Martin Road.
Yes.
And there was us. Yes. And then there was Mowat brothers.
Right. Yes.
They were at the back of Treacher's, as it was. And the policeman was Mr. Bradford. The Mowats live on Hastings Road. And then that had the garage, there were two brothers. And then there was Dr.
Bruce Comrie.
Bruce, yes.
It'll come in a minute.
Well, he used to live up by then, the doctor, yes.
The policeman,
Mr. Bradford.
Mr. Beck used to live up there. He was a policeman. Mr. Farquharson did. He was a policeman.
I can't remember. That's before me.
But Mr. Bradford, a policeman, I don't think we ever had a Bradford as a policeman in the village. It doesn't matter.
Is the doctor still alive?
Yes, he is. His wife isn't. Yes, she died.
I might give him a ring and ask it. The daughter's name was Joan. I wanted to tell you about my early recollections. Did I do that?
Of the village?
No, of me being... Now, I'm going to go back a little bit to when I was born. I was born on the 7th of March 1931 at Sister Daisy Venables Hospital in Ormondville. I think all the babies in the area were born at Sister Daisy Venables Hospital. She was about the same age as my parents, sort of born around the 1900s, I think. And they became firm friends, and Sister Daisy, as we used to call her, even danced at my wedding. She was a great character. Then, I think I might have mentioned this, then it was in the Depression and Father built this land. He bought a farm, but before that, I'll go back a little bit to Dad's history and Mother's history. Dad's history at this stage. His father had come out from Denmark at a very early age. My grandfather Niels came from Denmark, and he was born in Norrie Bork on the 20th of October 1853. His parents had seven children. And he came out here to New Zealand, I think, from stories that I've heard. At that time in Denmark, things were pretty grim, and there didn't seem to be, he couldn't see much future. So he arrived out here, and eventually got to Kaikoura North, as it was called, and is now known as Otani, as there's a Kaikoura in the South Island. He met my grandmother, who had also come out from England with her parents. Grandma came out in 1865, and in 1887 they were married in Christ's Church at Te Ati, which has been restored and is still standing. Howard was the third son, and they were all born in Kaikoura, except Uncle Eric. Grandfather started the bakery, and then he went up to the farm, which was the Ormondville Norswood Road, and this house is still standing there today. They used to walk to school, to the Ormondville School. Things were pretty grim, I think, but they got a smattering of education and left when they were about 12 and started working either on the farm, or Dad and Uncle Ivan actually got to the stage where they drove flat tired cream trucks for the creamery. That is where he met Mother, who used to be a domestic worker in the Nikolaisons' home. And everybody was very friendly by the sounds of it. And then they went up to Ormondville, to Norswood. My first conscious thought was, anything that I can remember is being put to sleep in the hay.
Oh, yes, you did mention.
Yes, I have mentioned this, how Mother milked the cows. But I just wanted to get that little bit in about the family at Ormondville. When Granddad died, Uncle Ivan was left a piece of land there, as was Uncle Chris, the eldest one, and Uncle Eric, and they all lived in that area. Well, Uncle Chris and Uncle Eric lived that, and Aunt Jean, Uncle Chris's wife, they all lived in that area, and Max and John and their sister all lived in that area. So they've got quite a lot of history there. And we used to go down to Sunday dinner and have it with Uncle Chris and Aunt Jean. And my parents still lived there until they died. And my Auntie Nett, who was Harriet after Grandmother, she looked after Granddad until he died a year after Grandmother. And I vividly remember going down to there, and he had a little beard. I don't remember him, I suppose he had a moustache, but he had a little corner up by his eye, which I, as a kid, used to sort of stand on my tiptoe and kiss up there where there was no whiskers.
Oh.
And he was a lovely old chap. I remember him quite candidly. And when I had a birthday, Auntie Nettie would say to him, "Father, do you remember what day it is?" And he'd say, "What was that? What was that?" And she'd say, "Remember, it's Faye's birthday." Oh, and he'd put his hand in his pocket and he would give me half a crown.
Mm-hmm.
And that was 2 shillings and 6 pence. And that was a fortune.
I know.
And if my sister was here, she said he never remembered mine or Ross's, but he always remembered Faye's. I stayed with them a lot. And one of my memories of my grandmother was she'd fallen and she'd broken her hip, and she was put into the Dannevirke Hospital, and they weighed her leg out, evidently, to pull the bones apart and got them together to hold them to knit.
Mm.
And unfortunately, the pulley as the story goes, the rope on the pulley broke, and of course they couldn't get it back, so that she was a cripple for the last years of her life. They used to get her out of bed and sit her in a chair in the sitting room, as it was called then, and she had a little stool, which I rue the day that somebody gave it to someone else instead of giving it to me. It was about 4 or 5 inches off the ground with a tapestry top. And I had to sit on that, and she gave me 2 4-inch nails. And on it was some stitches. And I had to learn to knit at her knee. Well, it was a pretty laborious job because she died when I was 7, so I wasn't probably, I can't remember what age I was when I learned to knit, but she taught me to knit. And I was terribly proud of myself. I can remember this as clear as anything. I did 2 rows after much effort, etc., and I thought, I can now knit, and that would be the tail end of it. But no, the next day Faye was called to the same spot, and the day after, and the day after, and the day after, until I knitted this confounded square, which took me forever, as you can imagine.
Yes.
But being grandmother beside me, I could no more not do it than fly to the moon, because grandma's word was law. And another thing that happened, but I do not remember this, where the kitchen table was, when I was toddling around and learning to walk, I fell and I put my hand on the top of the stove, and of course it stuck. And Grandma got me off the stove. I don't know how they did it. The tale didn't tell me that. But the thing that I was told by my aunt, she bound that hand up and she poured oil in it to it every morning. And, I mean, I've got no scars. Got nothing. It just shows you that some of the old ways did work and still work. I thought that was worth recording. In the kitchen, there used to be the phone. They had the phone on when I was young, and of course, it was on a party line, just as our phone was at the farm. I don't know how many were on the party line at grandfather's. But it used to ring, and every now and then he was asked to go to the phone. And I can see him now holding the thing out about 18 inches and roaring into this little mic. It was like a little trumpet thing on the front of the phone. And he used to roar into that, but he used to hold the receiver right out here. And Auntie Nettie used to say, "Father, Father, put it against your ear so you can hear." But she used to have to stand there and make him do this all the time. It was great.
Yes.
At the farm where we were, there was something like 15 people on the line, and we all had numbers. Like ours was 18R, so that when you got a short, a long, and a short, that was yours, and S was 3 shorts, and so it went on. It was a bit of a trick, really. And Father used to say that the certain lady that was our neighbour always listened to everybody's phone call. I don't know whether it was true or not. It probably was. But there it is. Yes. We didn't have the mod cons that we've got today.
No, I know. No. So then you're in Hastings, you're 21. You've met this dashing young soldier who drives this MG car.
Yes.
You're working in the Havelock post office.
There it is.
All right. Well, at this stage, how about telling me something about Bill where Bill came from? And
yes, I can only do it from memory, I haven't got anything much history of the Hanna family. Bill's father, who I unfortunately never met, he died 2 years before I met Bill. He knew a lot about building. Whether he had trained as apprentice, I do not know. But at the time of the Napier earthquake, he was a foreman for the city council. That was before the war. And while he was quite young, he inherited some money. I think it might have been something through a lodge, but I'm not quite sure about that. But Bill's grandmother, his mother, said to him, "You are going to build a house with that money now," which I thought was a pretty modern sort of outlook for those times, because this was before the war.
Yes.
So that when Bill's father was called up to go to the First World War, he had already built a house in Vigor Brown Street, 71 Vigor Brown Street. While he was over in England, he met this nurse who was nursing in this, I don't know how much training Nana had had, but she was helping in this convalescent hospital. Mm. And they married at the end of the war, and she was what you would call a First World War bride.
Yes, yes.
He came home to Vigor Brown Street, and Nana came out on the big home boat was the rest of the wives. Mm. So he had a house already established, which seemed to be pretty good in those days.
Yes.
Bill was born in 1921. He was 10 years older than I was, and his sister was born the year later. He went to the Napier Boys High School, and I think he might have been a clever bugger, actually. By the sounds of various things that I sort of picked up over the years. And of course then the war, and he worked in the post office, and then of course the war came along and he went overseas, came back, and then he started with Shepherd and Appley at Havelock North Motors. I think he started off, now when I think of it, with an Army Indian motorbike, because he still had it when I met him, and I actually rode on that Army Indian in his coat, sitting on the back, and I loved it. I thought it was great, and you see and smell things all the way, that's all different. And he had that for some time, but he didn't use it. A friend of his used it quite a lot. Or before I met him, he had joined the car club, the Hawke's Bay Car Club. I think he was at the inaugural meeting at the Pasadena Tea Rooms in Hastings. In those days, the club used to hold hill climbs at Seafield Road, just out of Napier, Seafield Road, and he broke all the records. I think that as the records were made, he broke them and kept on doing it over the years. And by the time I met him, there was quite a big club. And I can't just remember when we started the club out at Tionapu. Yes, it was after we were married, because I used to drive a van sort of thing out, because we had to have an ambulance out there. And it was the ambulance. And I drove that out. We had great days, but before I met They used to drive at Ohakia when they had motor racing at Ohakia. He used to go down to Seatoun Hill Climb too in Wellington, where he met Sybil Lupp. It won't mean anything to anybody, but she had an MG and she used to race against it.
She was the Jaguar lady.
Oh, it was Jaguar. She had an MG at the start, but she had the Jaguar franchise. Yes. I met Sybil.
She was quite famous.
Yes, she was. Well, they used to race against each other. Actually, they remained friends too, because I met her and she used to come up and we used to socialise. And I can't remember the name of her guy, but she had a son, if I remember correctly, but I can't remember what his name either. That'll come to me in the middle of the night about 3 a.m. or something.
Yes.
He used to race too. And that sort of introduced... Bill was always in motor racing. When Angus Hislop came along and they put their heads together, that's another chapter. Motor racing was Bill's interest. And when Angus came along, and I think he was a very clever mechanic. He was self-taught. He had had no apprenticeship at all. But he could do things and suggest things to other people that they couldn't apprehend. Angus came along and he was interested, and he had this E-type Jaguar. And by that stage, Bill had quite a reputation around the area. And just going back a little bit, the garage was quite successful. We had car sales and all those bits of people, those sorts of things. And we used to have times when we had car shows where he would get together some interesting machinery and bring it up, and the public would come and gaze at it. And he was quite a progressive thinker. And then we had the car sales, etc., which was going strong. But Bill took on this Jaguar E-type. And we used to go, at that stage, Levin had just started a racetrack. And of course, it was like Manawa too. It was pretty easy to get down to Levinen back in the day and do some motor racing. And of course, that opened doors and it got wider. And then Pukekohe started, and they used to go up to Pukekohe. That was quite exciting. Actually, our first date, when I think of it, there was a meeting on at Manawa 2. Bill wasn't racing, but he kept up with what was happening. I don't think he got to the stage where he didn't really have time. But that was our first date. He said to me, asked me if I would be interested in going down to the Manawa 2 car racing with him. And I said, well, I've never been to a car race meeting in my life. And he said, would you like to come? So that was our first date. Yeah. And the rest is history.
Yes.
But then, as I say, Angus came on the scene and Pukekohe opened, Levin opened. I don't remember Angus racing at Manawa 2. I think Levin took the motor racing of the area, and we went down there, and eventually they got braver and they did the circuit. Pukekohe opened, and Pukekohe was the first of the season, and when they started to get overseas drivers and people like Stirling Moss came out, and Graham, and all the other big racing names, world racing, And they did the circuit. They came here. They went to Pukekohe. We went to Levin. The next one was across the channel to Christchurch, which was at the Wigram circuit. And we then went down to Invercargill. That was the third. And we would come back to Waimate. Oh, and I've forgotten Blenheim. Before you went to Pukekohe, this Blenheim, I don't think the overseas drivers there, but they cut their teeth on Blenheim. And I remember one time Bill used to do all the bookings and the ferry bookings, and they wanted to charge him for the tow car, the trailer, and the racing car all separately. And he said no. So they took the case, and Angus said, how are you going to do that? He said, well, we're going to take the trailer down and leave it at Shelley Motors for a start, and we're going to drive the open wheeler down, the Cooper, the first Cooper Angus had. He said, oh God, we've got to have a silencer on, we've got to have a rear vision mirror, and we've got to have this, and we've got a number plate. And Bill said, just... So he put a number plate on it, and so and so and so and so, and he went on. And I remember him telling me, when they were driving from the ferry to the track, this traffic officer stood and watched them, and he walked all around the car, but he couldn't fault it. And then a big grin broke all over his face, and he walked away. And so that was the first thing they went to. But then, as I say, when Pukekohe came and we got the overseas drivers, they did the circuit to Waimate, and it took about 5 weeks all in.
Well, you mustn't forget Tionapu.
Oh, well, we mustn't forget Tionapu.
And the flying quarter at Bridge Power.
Oh, yes, I've forgotten about those.
Because they were the teething, because as schoolboys, Colin Wake and Graham Robson and I used to bike out and watch the cars.
I've forgotten about that.
Yes, and we used to bike to Tionapu Hill.
Yes, I haven't forgotten Tionapu, but I've forgotten the mile thing out there.
Yes,
yeah. And then, so that there was something happening all the time. And all with the overseas jokers coming out, the drivers, there was some Jack Brabham came, Sterling Moss, Graham, all these others that came out, lots, there was, you know, half a dozen of them, they were all great, and of course, the entertainment, we were very friendly with Ross and Hazel Jensen and the Pukekohe committee, you know, and it was one big happy family. We used to go up and stay, of course, for the few days, because it was, there was practice, there was scrutineering, there was practice, and then there was the meeting and the day to recover. Came home on Sunday.
Names like Bill, the Crosby Special.
Yes, that's Eden, right. And there was Sid Jensen in Palmerston North.
I know.
That he used to drive a MG2. He was very highly thought of. He was a lovely man. And all these guys. And, of course, with the overseas coming out, Parnell came out as manager for one of the teams. And Angus got recognised as being a rather accomplished driver. And then the Pukekohe and Co. committee decided that they would send a New Zealand driver to do the European as driver from New Zealand. And of course it was in the time of Denny Holm, who became a great mate. And Denny was the first one to be picked. He went. I can't remember the chap that went with him. There was always two picked, because you had to have two people, somebody to look after the driver and the car and the driver.
Sure.
Denny went and did extremely well, as history will note. And then a couple of years later, or a year later, I'm not quite sure, might have been a year or 2 years later, I think it was 2 years. I think actually when Denny went, they picked someone else as well. Another driver as well, two drivers, no, I can't remember. And yeah. I think, not sure, but I think there was a catastrophe there. I'm not sure. Anyhow,
sure.
But Denny went, and Denny was the one that we got to know extremely well. And then Bill, I think a couple of years later, Angus was picked with Bill to go as well. And Bill didn't, I know that Bill didn't know what to do. And Angus used to ring up. I could see what was going to happen, but Angus used to ring up at night and Bill would get up, usually at dinner time, Bill would get up to time. And there was, I sort of got this, the phone was in the lounge, just we had an open planning house just around the corner from the dining room, and I'd hear this one-sided conversation that was sort of yes and no and haven't and all the rest of it. And anyhow, one night he came back from the table and his mother and sister was there, and I said to him, "When are you going to tell me when you're going to go?" And he looked at me, and Nana picked it up. She said, "What are you going to do, Bill?" And he said, "I'm going to go with Angus Hislop to Europe." Well, Grandmother went into Nana, as we used to call it. She went into Auburn and said he couldn't do that. He had a new son and a baby daughter, and he couldn't possibly do that and leave Faye, etc. And I sort of calmed things down. I said, "Yes, Nana, he is going to do it." Because Angus wouldn't go without her.
Sure.
So they went off, and of course they did very well, etc. Before we got into all this motor racing business, we had been married at Havelock North in the old church, Presbyterian church. Bill's would not get married until we had a new house to go into, so we built a new house in Crosby Street, which was a very nice Barry Sweet architectural design. And one of the things that I think I should recall here is that Bill, being a return serviceman, got 2 years interest-free $2,000, which in those days was a lot of money. But, of course, the state advances had to approve the plan. So Bill sent it in, or Barry sent it in, I don't know, somebody sent it in, and Bill received the letter to say, "I'm very sorry, we have received the plans of your future home, Mr. Hanna, but you will understand our difficulties. We cannot approve it because only pigsties are built on concrete floors." And of course, this was one of the first concrete floor they'd ever had to approve of. So Bill got hold of Barry and they went along to see this man, and Barry described how the layers of different things were under the cement, etc., and it was going to be a thing of the future and there was no need to worry about it. It wouldn't fall down or crumble or anything. So we got the loan and we were at Crosby Street. Pauline had been born and Bruce was a couple of months old when Bill went over to the Europe. And they were sitting the week before they went, they were sitting together discussing things, and they'd agreed between the two of them, and I don't know which one suggested it, that they needed what they called a gopher. And I looked at them and sort of thought, what's a gopher? And it was explained to me that you really need, in a thing like this, a person who can do the odd jobs and the things that you haven't got time for. And Bill got straight up out of his seat and said, "I know the very guy." And my brother, at that stage had finished his carpentering apprenticeship and he was working as an overseer in Watties on night duty. Bill went to the phone, rang him and said, "Can you explain the position?" Bruce said, "I'll go and put my resignation in right now. I'll see you in the morning." And that's how it did. And he had, I always say, he was going up the plane at Napier with, they were jabbing the last thing in into his backside, because in those days you had to have all sorts of inoculations before you went overseas. And of course, I've got the photo here to prove it. The official photograph is this one that they took in Auckland. They all look as though they're going to a funeral or something, they've had a terrible argument about something. But that's the official photo. And unfortunately, those lovely black New Zealand blazers they've got, Bill was always very, very careful about security and things. And they were at a hotel or a motel or something in a locked yard in Italy somewhere. And when they went out to the car in the morning, the doors had been jimmied open and the only thing that was in the cars was their three blazers that were in a box all together, and they didn't take it out. And they usually did, but they were so tired this night, Bill said, that they took what they needed and left the rest, and they got cleaned out that night. So that we haven't got that lovely memento to show the next generation. But that was very successful.
Did you work during the time you had your children, or did you stop work?
We got married in April, and I went back to... They asked me to go back to work for the motor registration, which was in June, which I did. I suppose we needed the money as well. It didn't hurt, and I went back for that. And I worked then until I was expecting my first child, Pauline, who was born in February, probably, a couple of years out. And then when Bill went overseas with Angus, I did the office work. And I had somebody to look after the children. Sure. A very, very kind Mrs. Lowe that lived opposite said, "I will come and look after the children." And I used to go back. I used to finish at 2:30 in the office and started at, 8:30. So I did the office work, which I, of course, found easy enough with my training.
Right. Yes.
So it all worked in rather well. And we had this lovely little new house. And Jill Lowe came and looked after the kids, and we stayed in that house until we only had two bedrooms in it. It was open plan, was very, very nice place. The aunts used to say to me on the side, "Why is Bill only building two bedrooms, Faye?" Yeah. And I mentioned to it once, and he said, I won't tell you what he said, but he intimated that if we had more money, he'd build 10 bloody bedrooms. And that's another story. But we were very happy in Crosby Street. And my brother, who went with him, when it was time to come back, he never came back.
Oh, my goodness.
My brother. They came in on their own, and cut another story short, my brother went into business, did very well for himself. The only time he came back to New Zealand was when my father was ill. Mm. Howard just said to Bill, "Get Ross back, please, because we had the farm still and decisions had to be made, etc., business decisions." And Ross came back, taught Mother how to drive, who'd never learned to drive, taught Mother how to drive because Dad went at 64, in 1964, at the age of 64, of cancer. Nothing could be done. So he came back, then he went back to New England, And he only ever talked about coming back once. He's now gone, unfortunately. He died about 4 years ago. He talked about coming back to New Zealand at one stage, and he even talked about coming for good and buying, but then he's decided against it. And I said to him, he said, no, he thought he was too entrenched. He'd never married. And I said, well, good if you're there, because I said, all your nieces and nephews are about to descend on you in dribs and drabs, and you'll be a jolly good base. And absolutely, that's exactly what he was. When Pauline was the first to go over, and he bought a camper van.
Did he
for
really?
Them,
oh, wasn't that great?
For to go on, and she spent 5 months on the continent with another couple, and they had transport, new transport.
Absolutely.
And, of course, the others that went eventually, I never used it, but some of the others did.
Yes, yes. Oh, that's
so
wonderful.
That was wonderful. But he loved England and...
So when you were living in Havelock, apart from your motoring interest, did you have any other interest? Did you play tennis still or any sports phase?
No, I didn't. At that stage, I had a lot. I joined the Plunket quite early. That was something, but not very. But with the kids growing up and with modern school, Bill kept me in some sort of wagon all the time, so I could put the seven-a-side rugby team in the back. Not you can't do it now, and the pushchair, and because Tracy was born 9 years after Bruce, and there was a lot of school work and things like that that I went in, and I didn't actually play any sport until I came out here actually, and I joined the golf club. Bill wasn't.
Did Bill play golf?
No, he had a back.
Because
he had a bad back.
Gus used to play golf, didn't he?
No, not really. They had
The Crownthorpe.
Crownthorpe, if you could call that playing golf.
They thought they were pretty good up there.
Oh, they were, and I used to play up there. And
yes,
we had a friend, Owen Winsteel, that we met. He was the Shell rep for Shell when we were motor racing.
Yes.
It was a lifelong friendship. And they used to come and stay down here in this house. And Owen used to play golf. And he used to love me taking up to Crownthorpe because he just liked the atmosphere, and hopefully the farmer would be moving some stock so that he could go and help on one occasion. And he just loved it. It was an institution,
I know.
Quite different from anyone else.
Yes. So then you left the village and you moved out to here, a farmlet with asparagus growing.
No. We came, we decided the house, we were having another baby, and we decided we would not add on to our existing house. We would come out here. I knew exactly what we wanted, and I told the land agent what we wanted, and they took me to everything but what I wanted. And I got really uptight about it. And the land agent and I, and we decided we'd add on. And then the land agent rang up one day and said, Mrs. Hannah, I have found what I think is exactly what you and Bill would love with the family. And I said, we're not even slightly interested. We're going to build on here. And I said, so we won't. When my dear husband came home and I explained to him, he said, Faye, I think you're making a mistake. I think we should go and see that house. And I said, I will only go for it if you will take the time off and come with me, because the others, I had to do it all.
Yeah, sure.
So we were picked up, and we came out, and we kept on coming out. To me, it was quite a long way. We kept on coming out to Yatta Road, because I said to him, where is this house? And he said, it's out at Longlands. Well, we kept on coming and kept on coming. And we came up the long drive. There were no trees anywhere. You could see to Amnes Lime across the paddock. There was no orchards, there was no nothing. But we came up the drive, there was no hedge, and we could see Cyril Watson was living, and his orchard was all out in pink blossom. Mm. It was a beautiful day, and he came in, the drive was, there was no trees much, but mm. we came in around the drive. And the land agent got out to get the key, and I got out of one side of the car and Bill the other, and we walked round the back of the car, and he looked at me and I looked at him. I said to him, I can see the Hannahs living here. He said, so can I. So we went through it, and I won't go into details in the state the new house was in, because that's other people's business. But there was very, that tree out there was about that high and about that big round, and the palm that's at the front gate, Bruce used to jump over that, it was about that high. Mm. There was nothing here but lawn. We walked through it, it had four bedrooms, a den, it had a walk-in pantry, it had lots of windows, it had just everything. It was only 2 years old. It was in its second year, and we loved it. And Bill walked out to the agent and said, with the proviso that Helena Brothers would come out and inspect it, give it a pass, we would be only too pleased to buy it. So we did, and Helena said, yes, buy it, and here we are. And we've been here. We came in here when Tracy was, she was a year old in the December, and we moved in on Christmas week.
Yes.
And there was nothing out there except Maureen Harper had a stud, Pody stud. And there was just a whole lot of little paddocks all falling to bits.
No.
It was in a dreadful state. They'd tried to grow an orchard with a few apple trees out in the sheep paddock there, but they hadn't done anything, and the animals that they had and had knocked them down, and all. It was in an awful mess.
Yes.
And there were about 90 trees on the property, gum trees, which evidently in the flowering season were beautiful, but never been looked after, and the power board had hacked them down every year. And when we came here, before we moved in, they came to see Bill at the garage and said, Mr. Hannah, we believe you've bought Mr. Harper's property, and those gum trees have to be cut again. They said, after this, we'll have to charge you for cutting them. Or, they said, if you would like us, we will drop them for you. Bill said, drop them. So we came with a terrible mess down at the road frontage, and the kids weren't very old, and they would tell you that every time we got out of bed on Saturday morning and Father stayed at home, he would sit at the bar, there was a bar in the kitchen there, to have breakfast with the kids, and he'd say, now what are we going to do today? And the kids would the two oldest ones would say in chorus, oh, the trees! And we had to do a big racing trailer of trees, of rubbish and stumps, because he bought a chainsaw, and we had to bring the wood up and stack it down at the fence down there everywhere. And we had wood for years. But it was soon cleaned up. And by that time, he'd got someone to take all the fences and the wire out of the place. The electricity used to go across to a power pole about halfway between the neighbours and us until it had sagged so much that the tractor driver that came to plough up the stuff ready for the asparagus just about got hooked up in it, and et cetera. So we had to do something about that. So Bill had the electricity put under the ground, and it comes up the boundary under the ground so nobody could get electrocuted. And then we planted asparagus. We still had the garage at that time. We had it in 10 lots, and I had women that came in who were extremely good to pick every morning. We used to pack it into crates. Bill used to come home at lunchtime. We'd load it on the trailer, and he used to take it into Watties. But then we sold the business and came out here. We looked at the finances and what we could take off the land, and actually asparagus was good, but you really needed 50 acres or 100 acres to make an income.
That's right.
So that at that stage there was it wasn't fruit growers, but it was a committee of people who were looking to plant boysenberries in.
Yes.
And of course it was sold to us as a good income, and there was 10 acres here, and they said that was a good income, etc. So that's how the boysenberries got in. We went down to Nelson, talked to the guys down there who were very, very helpful, went around the area because there was a lot of boysenberries there. I think there are still quite a few, but I don't really know, because times move on and I think most of them have died off.
Yes,
like they have, but here. And at one stage, there were 25 boysenberry growers here when Bill was doing the work, but of course, we had all these boysenberries and we were sending it overseas, and it wasn't really terribly good. There was a return, but a lot took them out after a couple of years and planted other things. Like Tony over here opposite us, he had them. Well, he's got his an orchard now. Yes, it's probably getting him far better than the orchard. But we kept on going, and it was fun, and we met lovely people. I've got beautiful photos of the gang that used to come and pick it. And I'm tired up. There's a lot of manual work in boysenberries, but you do have the period sort of at the end of, by the time you get the cane cut down in February, until we always started after Queen's birthday weekend, you've got that period to sort of catch up with other things. I kept on going and did it when I lost my husband, and now Bruce has taken it over. So it's very satisfactory far as I'm concerned.
At what stage did Bill depart us? What year was that?
I thought you were going to ask that. Yes, well, we put these berries in and they were very successful, and Bill had been a townie and lived in a town all his life, never had lived on the land, really. He thoroughly enjoyed, the first tractor he bought was an old Fergie tractor, which we've still got, and then he bought himself a brand new tractor, so that was lovely, and he thoroughly enjoyed pottering around and doing the work on the farm. And when Bill went, he didn't see his 70th birthday, unfortunately. When he went, I had worked with him on the property, so I just kept going. I went, of course, everybody was offering me advice. I even had somebody before the funeral ask me if I was going to sell the land, would I give them first offer, which I felt was a bit cheeky. So as everybody was giving me so much advice, I went to see the bank manager, who was new to the area, but he came to Bill's funeral, and we'd both met him, had been out here, and we both found him very, very helpful. John Spittle was the bank manager at the National Bank. So I went in, and we'd only known him for a few months, but I put the position before him and asked for his advice. And I said to him at the time, I don't know whether I'll take it, but I'd like to hear your opinion. And he said to me, there's just two things. He said, can you live on your own, Faye, out there? And I said to him, well, I don't really know because I've never lived on my own. And he said, the other thing is, he said, do you know the management of the place? And I said, yes. And he said, well, he said, I don't see why. If you want to, you just don't keep going.
Yes. Mm.
So I said, thank you. I was hoping you would say that, but I just wanted an outsider's opinion. So I did. And, of course, Bill died at the end of May, and we always started putting up the cane at the after Queen's birthday, which was in a few weeks' time, and a whole lot of the gang came to Bill's funeral. And I said to them, would you just give me a couple of weeks to catch my breath, and then we could start putting up the cane. And on this first day, in the middle of June, they came up the drive, and Marta, who was the matriarch of the gang, said, now, girl, don't worry about us. We'll get this job done for you. She said, just keep bringing out the morning and afternoon tea. And, of course, they did. And they came back every year. There was a little bit of a funny bit at one stage, or there was several funny bits, but one bit that stands out as someone's just looking at the photos of the hangi. They came to me about the second year after Bill went, and they said to me, now, Faye, would you mind if we had a hangi? And this was quite new to me. I'd never heard of them having a hangi. They said, they looked at me and they said, well, we've often thought it would be lovely to have a hangi out here, but we knew that the big boss, he wouldn't have eaten the food. They said, would he? And I said, probably not. But they said, you will, so can we have a hangi? So I said to them, yes, you can. And I was very interested in what happened. The first thing at daylight, the men came out and bought the special stones.
Yes, yes.
About four or five of them came out, and they dug the pit because there was no pit at that stage. And they dug the pit. And this was all on the day that we were having the hangi. And then the women came out and they lined the whole hole with white sheets or some linen of some description, and the sides of it, and all the baskets that were all lined, etc., etc. And I was very impressed was the way it was managed and the beautiful food that came out of it. And of course we used the Fergie tractor, someone backed the track when it was open and brought it all down up, and we had it in the shed as usual, where we always had something on the last the day after they finished. They always wanted to go home and prepare some food. They wouldn't let me do it all. Prepare some food and change out of their working clothes, they said. And they used to bring the children too. And some of them I see now are great big guys in their 20s and always come up and give me a kiss, which is very nice.
Yes, yes.
And that was lovely. And just on an aside, this year, in the year of 2016, my son and Shelley, the family, have woofers to work, and you'll probably know by now what a woofer is. They're all over New Zealand. Bruce always has three caravans, and we have three couples and sometimes others. But my grandson, now who is 19, said, Grandy, this year he took charge, did a lot of work with the woofers. He said, Grandy, I think we should have a hangi. He said, it's part of New Zealand's culture. And I said to him, I don't know anything about hangis. I said, I know you have stones and a pit and things. He said, oh, don't worry about that. I'll fix all that up. To the stage that I didn't see this, but I was told he had all the woofers making flax baskets, and they had, the people that we had here had Christmas dinner out of the
hangi.
Good Lord. And I thought that was pretty good. Mm. That's a New Zealand experience that probably a lot of them wouldn't get anywhere else.
Yes, yes. You were saying that it's your grandson, is it? That's
my grandson, yes, Bruce's son, because yes. Bruce took over about 10 years ago, I suppose. Yes, it would have been at least 10 years ago. And he runs the place, and I just look at far. I take them down the odd morning tea when they've got the shop open. Of course, he, being another generation, has changed the whole format of the property. Mm. In my day and Bill's day, we put it into packaging, the crates that the canneries supplied, loaded it up and took it to either Watties, we had contracts with Watties, and then grower canneries as well when they came.
Sure.
But the whole format of the garden under Bruce has changed dramatically, and I was still doing that when he took over.
Yes, and so now a big proportion of the berries have gone.
Half the berries have gone. I found it was too much. Mm. Half the berries have gone, and he's taken over, and in the last couple of years he's taken some more of the berries out and has now got cherries planted, which will come into fruit this year. He doesn't supply very much to the canneries at all. He individually freezes the berry, the IQF. He sells at the gate, he sells at the market, and he's also gone into glass. And he makes jam and chutney and green salad slick. He has a sweet sauce to put on fruit.
Oh, that's lovely.
What else does he have? We have cakes that he gets made from boysenberries. What else do we have? And this year, a new thing, he has bought a very smart van and a new equipment, and we serve fresh fruit ice cream now.
Oh, do you?
Mm.
Down at the gate here?
Yes.
In the season?
Yes, we start the season as soon as the berries are picked with fresh fruit, and it closes when there's no berries left.
Sure.
But we kept on a little bit longer this year because the ice cream proved extremely popular.
Yes.
And it's all made there with the machinery that he's got.
Mm.
And it's fortunately a new way of making money with the product.
Well, it's no longer you're no longer passing it for someone else to take and manufacture and make all the money.
You're making it yourself.
You're taking all the profit.
You're taking it. And he sells a lot of packaged berries during the season, stores a lot of stuff here, and he takes the rest out to Whakatū Cool Stores and brings it back. But it's all our berries, and it's all ready, and he sells it in various weights all the year, really. And of course, he's on the internet. It's a marketable what?
So now that you've extricated yourself from running of the farm, and 10 years ago you said that it's happened, you probably still have an interest in seeing it's all happening around you.
Well, yes. People say to me, have you got your name down at Mary Doyle? Which people that might be listening to this probably don't know what Mary Doyle is, but it's a retirement village type thing. And I say, why would I put my name down at Mary Doyle? And they say, why not? And I say, well, I've got a perfectly nice house at Longlands. And I said, my daughter-in-law is in financial planning, and she has an office in my house, because Bruce and Shelley built a small house when they came, and I'm in the bigger house. And I said, Shelley does her business from here. Bruce does all his business from the den, which I used to use and my husband used to use for the business part of it. I have watched my grandchildren grow up and see them forwarding on in life. why would I want to lose?
Oh, no.
If I've got my health, this is where... I said, they can carry me out feet first.
So now you're in retirement here in this lovely ground surrounding your house, sun, the lovely windows you've had since your first home.
Yes.
And what could be better?
Well, I play croquet, I paint, I go to aerobics, I entertain. There's really, they say that sometimes life is heavy on your hands when you retire. Well, I've got news for people. There's plenty of things to do. There's no need to be bored.
Now you've opened this Pandora's box of family history.
I don't know when I'm going to get all this done.
I know. So anyway, that pretty well covers the whole field, doesn't it? But if there's something else we need to address, we can always put it on as an addendum on the end of this.
Well, I would quite like to speak about my great-grandparents and my grandparents on my father's side and my mother's side, but I think that's for another day.
How much would that take?
We've talked about Niels,
yes,
and grandmother.
Yes.
Well, perhaps I could just put a little bit on. We've talked about grandfather Niels from Denmark and grandmother who came, grandmother Harriet, who came from Staffordshire. They were married at Te Ati. I think I might have mentioned that. But my other grandparents, my mother's parents, they came out with a big family from England. And they were interested in timber. And, of course, Hawke's Bay was covered in timber when they arrived.
Yes.
And they obviously had experiences with milling. And they had mills here and in Tamarunui. Emma, who my grandmother's name was, Emma lost her first husband when he was in his late 20s with a mill accident and had all these children to bring up. She then later in life married a George Meyer, and they had one child who was my mother. She was also Emma Francis. They all lived around here. My various uncles went to the First World War. They settled around the Dannevirke area and the Nakutiku area in Tamarunui. Both my aunts, Aunt Mary and Auntie Hattie, lived in Dannevirke with various people that they married. Jim Moisey and Alfred Smith, and had big families. Faye Hannah's relations had a lot to do and worked very hard in their lives, and most of them were in Hawke's Bay.
Right.